KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Daniel Nazer, a staff attorney and policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. And we're going to be discussing a topic that we've discussed several times here on Hearsay Culture, the issue of non-practicing entities or patent trolls. Depending on your perspective, these are individuals or organizations who acquire patent portfolios or individual patents, but usually portfolios. And then they use those patents in a variety of ways, but most controversially to bring patent infringement lawsuits against other entities that they allege are infringing these patents. Listeners to Hearsay Culture, even non-lawyers who have been listening regularly, have heard about patents quite a bit on the show, not just patent trolls, but we spent a lot of time on the show discussing patent reform issues both prior to and after the American Invents Act. And we've also spent a lot of time talking about monopolies and innovation more broadly. So patents has been a regular topic on Hearsay Culture going back 7 years. And it continues to be not only a major area for Hearsay Culture, but of course a very important policy for those concerns about innovation and ownership of property, not only in the United States, but abroad. So patent trolls have been, probably at least recently, perhaps the most highly controversial area in patents, although there have been issues and continue to be issues involving certain subject matter that should not be patentable, software and business methods and what have you. But today we're going to really drill down heavily on the issue of patent trolls or non-practicing entities. A few months ago at this point, I had on Ron Epstein of Epicenter IP. He is one of the major non-practicing entities out there, although he had his own names for these organizations. And so I had Ron on to kind of offer his perspective as one of these individuals and entities on what he was doing and the benefits and drawbacks. But in the interest of covering the issue more broadly, I also wanted to have on someone that has a very different view, representing an organization that has a very different view about non-practicing entities. And so I'm very excited to have Daniel on today. Daniel, by way of this background, is part of the intellectual property team at EFF. Prior to joining EFF, he was a resident fellow at CIS, where I was a resident fellow in 2005 to 2007. He was also with Kecker and Van Nest in San Francisco. He was a clerk to a judge on the Federal Court of Australia, as well as Judge William K. Sessions of the United States District Court for the District of Vermont. He has a BA in philosophy from the University of Western Australia and has in philosophy from Rutgers, a master's, and a JD from Yale. I should say up front, by way of a disclaimer, that I have occasionally given very small, I am a law professor, of course, very small donations at EFF. I generally support much of what EFF does. And so it is occasionally a challenge to put on a journalist hat and ask questions of guests who are affiliated with organizations that I tend to agree with. But in the interest not only of academic inquiry, but more importantly, from the perspective of Hearsay Culture, pedagogy and teaching, because I founded the show 7 years ago with the goal of having broader discussions about these issues outside of the traditional realm where those conversations take place, that is academia and think tanks and so forth. My interest here is not to, as those of you listen to the show regularly, convince anyone that any particular side is right or wrong, and I do my best to ask questions in as neutral a way as possible and also reveal any perceived or actual biases that I might have in the questions that I ask. So with that caveat, Daniel, who is joining us via Skype from EFF's offices in San Francisco, thank you very much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me.
So, Daniel, let me ask you this question. And I should say we are recording on November 20th for airing today, so this is a very timely show. Let's start off. I mentioned briefly your background, but perhaps you could tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
So I studied patents and property issues a bit in law school, and I wrote a paper about a quite different property issue, that's property and surfing waves, called The Tragedy Comedy of the Surfers Commons, that's in the Deakin Law Review. But I didn't get fully involved in the patent space until I was an associate at Kecker. And as I'm sure a few folks who practice in law firms will confirm, if you show any affinity or aptitude for patent litigation at a firm, you'll quickly find yourself getting as much of it as you could possibly want. It's you know, one of the few areas of legal practice that's been growing, and where big firms and sort of high-end firms still get a lot of work. And it's not always the most popular area to practice at an associate level because there's a lot of discovery, but I found it really fascinating, and most of my 4 years or so in private practice I spent doing patent litigation.
And so I mentioned your background a bit, and so I digging a little bit deeper. So you got you started getting these assignments, and I was in private practice as well. And one of the phrases that was used with some regularity was the phrase "you eat what you kill," which is a very kind of dramatic way of saying if you're assigned to a case, it's yours. And I'm curious, from your perspective, doing that work, how it's colored your thinking on what we're going to talk about for the bulk of the interview, patent trolls or non-practicing entities.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very good question, because you see in the patent world and patent policy, people with very, very different views of how much good patents are doing in the economy. And folks who earn their living filing patents tend to think patents are great. And folks who earn their living defending people who are accused of infringing patents tend to think patents are pretty terrible. And I think the reason I'm going to make a case for patents not doing nearly as much good as they're supposed to do is that the people who are out there defending, in almost all cases, you're defending people who, even if they do infringe, independently develop the technology. And so the whole process is just a dead weight loss for the economy, because the patent didn't incentivize something that you wouldn't otherwise have.
So I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
And that was certainly my experience. I didn't exclusively work litigating against patent trolls, but I did spend a lot of time, including a big trial down in the Eastern District of Texas. And it is when you find yourself arguing about really, really complex technologies in front of lay jurors in Tyler, Texas, about stuff that was developed in Japan and Taiwan, and it starts to seem like a very, very strange way to distribute the spoils of innovation.
So you mentioned something interesting there, which I think, in order to frame the issue, is helpful. When we think about patents, right, we're thinking about monopolies that are granted by the government, as you mentioned, to incentivize the creation of new works. And you mentioned something important, which we should flesh out, the notion that patents aren't doing the work they're supposed to because people are independently discovering what is patented, which I think gets to a broader issue that kind of sets the stage of this discussion, which is the abundance of patents that are out there. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about the patent process itself, but also the amount of patents that are out there and how that creates this situation where people, as you point out, get patents on things that perhaps we don't need to give a monopoly to get in the first place.
Yeah, so there's been a really explosive growth in the number of patent applications, and it hasn't really been accompanied by an actual growth in innovation and R&D spending. And a lot of this is in the software space. So there are anywhere, estimates vary, but there's somewhere between sort of 40 and 70,000 software patents issued every year. And I think it's a very open question whether these patents are really incentivizing much of anything at all. If you look at the early years of Microsoft, for example, in the first 15 years of Microsoft, they grew to a $1 billion-a-year company, and they filed 5 patents. And today, Microsoft files about 2,500 patents every year. It didn't really change the greatly in terms of the nature of their company. You know, it's still basically a software company, and they do various other things, Xbox and things like that. But the idea that the patents are what's incentivizing Microsoft's R&D, I think is a hard case to make when you look at the history of the company. And that's true across the software industry, that everyone feels compelled to file thousands of patents per year just to build up a war chest. But everyone's basically filing patents on the same things, because every little invention, every little improvement is basically considered to be patentable by the PTO. The standards for obviousness and anticipation are not high enough, in my view, at the patent office.
So these, we won't get too far into the weeds of patentability, not obviousness and anticipation, except to say here that those kinds of hurdles are the hurdles that have, at least theoretically, were built into the law to prevent the kinds of problems that we're going to talk about here. Let me ask you this question again by way of background, Daniel. We're chatting with Daniel Nazer of Electronic Frontier Foundation on KZSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So how does EFF, and again, many listeners are familiar with EFF, but those that aren't, is a civil society public interest organization that not only does policy work, but also, as you mentioned, handles litigation directly on a variety of issues. And of course, your subtopic or subname, I should say, right on your website, defending your rights in the digital world. Perhaps you could kind of contextualize this issue around the broader concerns that EFF has traditionally over the last 20-odd years advocated for in technology and on the internet?
So that's a good question. The early days of EFF were really, EFF was founded to advocate for rights in the digital world and online. And the feeling was among the founders that courts and policymakers didn't understand the issues well enough. That was kind of a bull in China shop aspect to the way courts and administrative agencies were dealing with these problems. And a good example from our early history is a case about cryptography in the early 1990s. Programmers were required to register cryptography technology as a weapon, and it was regulated under sort of international arms treaties as if these were armaments. And we represented a cryptographer who wanted to publish a paper about new cryptography methods and wanted to do so without having to ask permission from the government first. And in that case, we got the court to agree that code is speech and that this was a burden on his First Amendment rights. And ultimately, that regulation of cryptography was defeated. And I think a lot of our patent work is in a similar spirit. It's the idea that people should be free to tinker and create without this, without restrictions that are warranted. And the case of software patents being overbroad and too many and too easy to get means that people who want to create new things end up being open to being dragged into court for lawsuits that shouldn't be happening.
So, Daniel, like I said, many listeners are familiar with patents, but let's focus a little more specifically on the topic for today. So, we have this moniker, patent trolls. We have this phrase, mm-hmm. non-practicing entities. Before we get into yours and EFF's position with regard to them, what are they? In an unvarnished way, what are they?
So patent troll, is obviously a pejorative term, and there's no one settled definition, which often leads to a lot of problems when people are debating policy in this area. The patent troll is kind of generally the idea is of a non-practicing entity. So it's a company that is trying to get revenue, whether through licensing or litigation, from patents, but doesn't actually practice the technology, doesn't actually make anything itself. And so there's a spectrum of behaviors here. So the worst patent troll would be the shell company that buys patents, say from a bankrupt company, and then goes out threatening lawsuits all over the country just to basically shake people down, maybe even nuisance lawsuits. And so that's sort of your trolliest troll is a company that does that. And then you might have, say, a university that is trying to engage in genuine technology transfer and find partners to develop new things, and patent licensing is part of that process. And that generally doesn't strike people as very trolly behavior. And so it's not easy to come up with a single definition that captures everyone's intuition, but I think I prefer the term patent assertion entity. Mm-hmm. and that's a company that's really purely trying to get revenue from a patent. I would really distinguish it from technology transfer. Genuine technology transfer usually involves more than just patent licensing. It involves know-how and teaching. If you just get a license to a patent, the patent on its own, even though it's supposed to teach you how to make the product or service, it's usually not that useful. When people are engaged in genuine technology transfer, the deals they do and the contracts they do are far more complex than just give me some money and here's a license for a patent.
So I will use the phrase patent assertion entity, or PAE, for the remainder of the interview. But it does raise this broad point, would you say, up front. You know, patent troll is pejorative. We have other phrases, but you know, it's not usually the case that we have an issue in IP law where we've developed a commonly used pejorative term for someone practicing IP, right? The people may have names or monikers that they might attach to those with whom they disagree, and certainly not the topic for today, but, you know, the ongoing battles involving copyright infringement is an example of it, and of course, depending on your perspective, you call it infringement or piracy. Here we've got something where we're labeling entities and individuals, and I'm curious, at a top level, on your perspective on that. I mean, is it useful to have a term that is admittedly pejorative when discussing what is a very complex policy question? So do you have any perspective? Because you're choosing to use a PAE, and perhaps I'll partially ask you why it is that you make that choice. But then with regard to the term patent troll, do you think it's useful to speak in those terms or use those kinds of phrases?
I think it's kind of a searching question. I think that the patent trolls basically – They gave themselves the terrible reputation that they have. The abusive litigation really is a big problem, and trolls are the worst. It's certainly possible for operating companies to abuse patents, and they do, but trolls are much more likely to. They don't have the reputational concerns. A shell company, they're often layered with layers of shell companies. It can be very difficult to figure out who's actually behind the activities of PAEs. And as these kind of pure litigation devices, their incentives are quite different from a company that might actually care whether or not people see it as a good actor. And so, and the most aggressive trolls tend to launch very bad lawsuits. There's a study that trolls that sue eight or more defendants, that subset of PAEs, when they lose, when those cases are actually taken to judgment, they lose over 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a justified sense out there that there's a sector of the patent landscape that is abusing patents, that's using the fact that defending patents litigation is really expensive to leverage money out of those that actually sell things and employ people and create revenue. So I don't think it's unfair that this term is used and that there's a focus on PAEs and that there's a pejorative term for being a PAE. I do think it can be distracting, and the fighting over who is the troll and who is not is kind of pointless. And the ultimate question really should be, is the system working? Is it incentivizing innovation, or is it punishing? Is it punishing independent development and competition? I'm kind of torn. To be honest with you, I'm kind of torn because if you see the current legislative efforts, it's directed at trolls. It's directed at PAEs and litigation reform. And I think the reforms will be good, and will particularly be good for startups and smaller businesses that are getting picked on by trolls. But it does sort of obscure the really big problem that trolls are just a symptom of, which is too many bad patents.
We're chatting with Daniel Naser of EFF on KZSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you've alluded to several harms here, Daniel, but with regard to PAEs, but I want to be explicit about it. So, you know, EFF, you know, has taken a very public and strong and leading position opposing this behavior. But if you could, you know, give us, you know, we'll dig in a bit, you know, a short list of the major harms with PAEs. Then I should add, and I'll cede it, of course, KZSU runs a radio show. I also run Hearsay Culture as a podcast, and that's been an issue. In fact, you had a post recently that was provocatively titled "Help Save Podcasting." So if you could, yeah, you know, if you could lay out the primary harms from your perspective of PAEs, and then perhaps the podcasting issue might be an example to give us a sense of what exactly we're speaking about when we say that these entities do things that from a social and policy perspective we don't want.
So the worst PAEs, and even some people who are very supportive of the patent assertion entity business model, generally concede that there is a subset of PAEs that are really the bottom feeders in this space and are very abusive. And those tend to launch lots of quick lawsuits, send out lots of letters, and they settle for not that much money because they know that it's even the initial stages of a lawsuit, especially a patent lawsuit, are very expensive. So even filing an answer and getting your act together to do the early pleadings in a lawsuit will easily set you back $50,000. So if a patent troll sues a company and says, we want $40,000, it's very difficult as a business matter to turn them down. And that kind of nuisance value settlement is pretty common in the patent space. And there are a lot of trolls that do that, and they tend to do them with very silly software patents. So there's one, for example, that has a patent on showing a static advertisement next to a video on a web page, and sues sort of one by one is suing a number of providers of entertainment content on the web. And they settle up for about $50,000. It's kind of a standard deal. And that's just money that's a drag on the economy. People, small companies, they have to lay people off when this happens. And the money's not flowing to innovation. It's just flowing into lawyers' and investors' pockets. I really don't think the patent system was essential for us to have static advertisements shown next to video on a web page. So that's sort of the big picture. And then going down to a specific case of the podcasting. So this is a case that's gotten a fair bit of coverage on NPR and other shows. So some of the listeners might be familiar with it. It involves a non-practicing entity called Personal Audio that claims to have a patent that covers podcasting. And this is interesting case in that Personal Audio, they deny being a troll because the company's still controlled by one of the original purported inventors. And so some people would exclude that from being a troll, others would say it is, and I would say it's not really important, it's just a pejorative label. But I think there's really no question they contributed nothing to podcasting that we see today. What they did was they filed a patent that basically describes some kind of personal audio device And then many, many years later, they filed a continuation in part with new claims. In their own words, they said they realized that buried in there was some ideas relating to podcasting. And so in 2009, they filed a new application and got new claims in 2012 that they say read on podcasting.
And yeah, so just, I may interrupt you there and just say, when you say read on, for those that aren't familiar with patent jargon, what does that mean exactly?
That means they'd cover. So patents, for folks that are less involved in the space than us, this is patents are broken into two parts, basically. There's one that's called the specification, which describes the invention, and then there are the claims. And the claims are often compared to the offense or meets and bounds in property, real property. So it's supposed to be the boundary of the patent. So, the classic example would be, a vehicle with four wheels and an engine, if you were going to write a claim to cover an automobile. And the personal audio say that their claims in their patent cover podcasting. And in this new patent that they got many years after podcasting came about, that they're able to claim priority back to 1996 thanks to the very, in my view, far too permissive rules at the PTO for getting new claims on patents many, many years after the original application.
So we've got some efforts that we're going to talk about after a short break that are designed to address these issues. And so I'll take that break now. We're dealing with a very, very controversial topic here on KZSU FM Stanford today on Hearsay Culture. And we are chatting with Daniel Nazer of EFF. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope they continue to listen to the show. So, these kinds of harms that you're talking about, Daniel, let me take the strong position on pushing back on those issues and see what your response is, right? Mm-hmm. If, in fact, right, we have a patent system that is granting too many patents, is that the problem of the PAE, right? In other words, they purchase and they acquire an asset that someone else who owned the patent is willing to sell. And now they are doing only what the law allows them to do. Now, put aside, for the moment, for the purpose of this question, put aside the reform issues. But as the law stands today, is there anything that PAEs are doing that itself is illegal or even from a perspective of regulation is problematic?
Right. The general business model is legal. There's not much doubt about that. It wouldn't be so successful and massive if it wasn't. There, at the margins, there's conduct that's arguably illegal. Folks that send demand letters on patents they know are expired or that they don't own or that they know they're sending them to people who are licensed. There are ways, as in pretty much any area, to make a false claim, and this does happen, and it happens quite a lot with patent demand letters, but that's really at the margins. Sort of the core business model is legal, and that's the problem.
So there it is. So I guess let me ask you this backtrack question, which is, how is it that it came to be that this is legal? Is it merely, is it only a function of the prevalence of patents themselves, or is there more going on that would create a business environment and an innovation environment where this activity could be as successful as it's been? Is it merely just a question of volume, or is there more going on in our understanding of how the innovation process has developed that has created this situation? Because at least the popular knowledge of patent assertion entities is fairly recent. But correct me if I'm wrong on that. Is there a history of PAEs out there that would explain why it is that this is happening now?
Yeah, I mean, they used to call them patent sharks in the 19th century, but it's never been on the scale of today. And I think there are a lot of factors to do with that. I think it's easier to buy patents now. It's a more liquid market. There's so many of them. And it's also the fact that patentees discovered in just in the last few decades that jury trials are more favorable for them and started going down to rocket docket favorable jurisdictions that they saw as favorable. And so that was something that's been driven by both PAEs and operating companies. I think a really big factor here is just the structure of the U.S. system compared to the rest of the world, in that in the U.S., the general rule is if you win a case, you pay your own legal fees. And so the PricewaterhouseCoopers, or I think they're just called PwC now, they do a litigation report every year, and they so the 2013 report shows that PAEs in cases that actually went to judgment lost 75% of the time over the last 5 years. So when you see that they're losing, when they're actually challenging court, they lose an overwhelming majority of their cases. You wonder, how is it that the business model can still be so successful? And the reason for that, I think, is that the settlement pressure in patent cases is just so high. It costs over $1 million. The average patent case is about $2 million to defend. Even small patent cases rarely are defended through trial for less than about $600,000. So, and that's money that in 90%+ of cases, the defendant is just going to be out of pocket, even if they win. So, and this is also why PAEs are so successful, is they have no reputational harms. They can bring, these shell companies can bring lawsuits and just tell the defendant, well, you can fight back, but it's going to cost you $1 million, or you can give me $100,000 now. And that's why people say it's like extortion. Even the president in February said that it can be this model can be like extortion. And so I think that's a big factor. You don't see a lot of PAEs in Australia and Canada and the United Kingdom, where they have a different fee structure model.
Other than the PAEs themselves, is there any other constituency or anyone else defending this behavior? I mean, is there any organized? Because as I mentioned, you've got debates going on in other controversial areas and IP. Is this an exception? In other words, is there unanimous opposition to this behavior outside of the PAEs themselves?
No, I mean, I think a lot of folks there's a lot of debate about how to deal with the most abusive PAEs. And those of us that think patent quality is a really big driver of this problem want broader reform. And that is getting a lot of opposition from some big patent holders. So particularly the BSA, which the Business Software Alliance, Microsoft, Adobe, IBM, Qualcomm. So a lot of these companies get a lot of revenue as patent licensing revenue, and they really don't want the system to be tinkered with. They don't want it to be harder to get patents, and they don't want their giant stockpiles of patents to be called into question. So they're really, a lot of those companies actually support reform. Microsoft is supportive of some of the litigation reforms that are being proposed right now, but they're very opposed to anything that deals with patent quality. But the strongest defenders of PAEs are the PAEs themselves, definitely. Intellectual ventures, particularly, is the elephant in the room on that topic.
So, you know, the debate, from how you're describing it, is not around the activity itself, but the solution, which is something I want to talk about in a moment. And again, we're chatting with Daniel Nazer of EFF on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, Daniel, and as you know, Ron Epstein from Epicenter IP, which is a patent assertion entity, a PAE, excuse me, was on the show a few months ago. And one of the points that he made that I want to ask your reaction to was that, and he, in fact, he wrote this in an article in Bloomberg Businessweek. He wrote that non-practicing entities, quote, may be vital to providing access to innovation, unquote, through resources, right, through having the ability to actually acquire patent portfolios and then back them up. So in other words, they become something other than non-practicing. They assert their patent rights, but they also bring products or services to market. What do you say to that? Is that factually accurate? Is it does it mean anything? I mean, what's your reaction to that kind of argument?
Outside of universities and their biotech startups, there is a community of people definitely involved in technology transfer, but that's, like I said, it's usually not pure patent licensing. And particularly in the software field, it's almost all about just building up stockpiles of patents for either offensive or defensive purposes. And it's not about technology transfer. In software cases, there's a great paper by Stanford's Michael Emily, and I believe he co-wrote it with Katrubia, on copying in patent litigation, and how common it is that copying allegations are found. And in the software space, they found less than 2% of cases actually involved allegations of copying. So it's almost always just extracting rents from people who independently developed the products. And I think that's the really key issue here about how unhealthy the patent system has become, that it's not about incentivizing innovation, that it's about giving people the opportunity through government-granted pieces of paper to extract rents from people who have the temerity to actually employ people and make things and sell things.
So let's talk about, and we're getting close to what I call, although we're not quite there yet, what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you don't have time to answer adequately in the space that we have. But we're almost there. So I think I have one more fair question for you. One issue that I've always found particularly challenging here, and it's a personal interest of mine, I can say that, is how we interpret claims themselves, how we actually understand what a patent claims to be covering. Okay, and there's been an increasing amount of scholarship on this issue of claim construction, and one of the interesting proposals that I wanted to run by you is one that Mark Lemley has proposed, involving functional claiming, right? To change how we allow patentees to write their claims, so that as it stands, and this gets very technical quickly, but I'll summarize it this way, and then feel free to add to it. Instead of allowing patent claims, that is what the patent actually says, to focus on steps and thing, you know, you do this and this and this and this, and it leads to this invention. Lemley's proposal, and I know I'm oversimplifying it, so feel free to textualize it more, would propose, and instead the claims say, we are inventing a device that solves this problem or does this thing, and leave these specific steps to really ultimately, again, this is kind of the issue, right, to litigation or to just general understanding of language. So that meta example of a potential reform raises this broader issue, which is the question of whether the challenge is not even just the patents themselves being issued, but the difficulty in figuring out what the patents mean. So what is your reaction to that as a potential reason for these entities to be existing? And then more specifically, do we need to change the way we understand and construe and interpret claims themselves?
So my answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Moving on.
I think it's a huge problem. And so what Mike Lemley is saying is that it's too common that people, particularly in software-related patents, they get a patent on the solution. And so when you look at the claims of software patents, it's very common to see, you know, a processor for or a machine readable that does thing that does X, or a computer. It's written in this very broad language that's basically just says, you know, a computer that solves this problem. And instead of it should instead, to the extent you even grant patents in this area, it should be on a particular solution that the person, that the inventor came up with. And I think he's absolutely right that far too many software patents are granted that are essentially given to the any kind of solution rather than to a specific problem. And I think it's really a feature of, we have a 19th century patent system that's trying to deal with 21st century problems. Our technology is software is, it's a very strange thing. It's something that's incredibly precise. If you get a computer program and you run it, the computer will do exactly what you tell it to do. But at the same time, if you then describe that program in just English, say using 100 words to describe, 5,000 line program, a lot of people would come up with very different words to describe that program. And so when we get these patent claims, you get these very vague, very hard to interpret claims that are supposed to be this fence, like a fence around a piece of land, but they're incredibly hard to interpret. And it makes it incredibly difficult for people, even if they wanted to avoid infringement. And so I think you're absolutely right that this is a huge part of why patent trolls have become such a problem, because there are so many patents out there that they can buy, and then they can take this vague language and say, well, you do that. And the patent probably doesn't have a lot to do with what you do, but the language is pretty vague, and it'll cost you $1 million to defend even if you win, so you give the patent troll $50,000. Whether fixing functional claiming will fix the problem is another question. I think the problem may, in fact, be so deep with the way software is very difficult to describe at high levels of abstraction that it's really just a bad idea to have a property system where you try to build these fences with words and then litigate about it in a court as a way to distribute the spoils of innovation.
Which raises this broad question that we don't have time for, which is literally the use of language, as you mentioned, to describe things that have physical attributes. And I'm going to actually leave it there on that topic, because that could open up easily at least another hour of discussion. Let's turn in the last eight or nine minutes that we have to the current reform proposals that are out there. And there's a lot of policy and advocacy work being done right now. Again, we're recording on November 20th, 2013, on these issues. The Innovation Act is one potential reform. There are others, but let's start there. What is the Innovation Act, and what's your take on it?
Yeah, so the Innovation Act, they had their mock-up hearing today, so they were debating amendments to it and the process. I think it's a mostly good set of reforms. It's very directed to the litigation fixing problems with the litigation system relating to patents rather than actually dealing with the core problem of patent quality. But it has a number of good reforms. For example, one thing it has is it will require what's being called heightened pleading, which means that someone bringing a patent case should have to specify what products and services infringe, what patents are infringed, what patent claims are infringed, and how they're infringed. Currently, to a lot of listeners, that might sound like nothing more than common sense. How could you file a lawsuit if you didn't have that information? But currently, we have what's called notice pleading, and it's very common to see patent suits filed where it's simply company X infringes my patent number, such and such, and that's it. And the company X is then really left to guess which of its products infringe, which claims. Patents can have as many as 100 different claims, and they can be quite different. Each one of those 100 claims is difficult to interpret. And none of that information is given to the defendant, and it will take them until well into the litigation process to get that information, and it will cost them probably $250,000 to get far enough into litigation just to know what the actual case is about. And so that's one of the reforms that's in the Innovation Act, I think, is very good. Surprisingly to me, it's very controversial. But another reform is delaying discovery of other than core documents until after claim construction, which is what we were just talking about, because claim construction often makes it clear whether there is a case there or not. Cases often settle shortly after claim construction, and it doesn't really make sense to do really, really expensive discovery of documents, which can easily cost $1 million, until that question is settled. There is a fee-shifting provision in the current version of the Innovation Act, which would help prevent trolls from being able to use litigation costs as a weapon. So it's all good, and taken together, I think it would really cut down on the most abusive patent trolls. But at the same time, it doesn't really fix the problem of tens of thousands of bad patents issuing every year.
Do any of these, the Innovation Act and others, if they're out there, I know this is a crystal ball question, but I'm curious. I mean, what's your sense of whether any of these bills are going to actually become law? This is a fluid area, but since I'm asking the question on the same day that we're recording, what's your sense as it stands now?
There is a good chance, as I'm sure you know, Congress is not been passing a lot of substantive bills in recent years. But this is one that could really break through the logjam because it has support on both sides of the aisle. There's been Leahy and Chairman Goodlatte, who's the Republican head of the Judiciary Committee in the House. Both have quite bills with overlapping provisions. The Innovation Act has bipartisan supporters. It doesn't have all of the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee supporting it, but it has some, and similar bills in the Senate have bipartisan support, and the President has made it very clear that he wants patent reform, and he wants it even this year. So as much as anything that's happening in Congress, there's a good chance that we'll get a substantive bill.
So, Daniel, in the last few minutes that we have, let me ask you kind of a couple more wrap-up questions. We have about 4 minutes. With regard to this broad issue involving patents, there's kind of a – and it's not directly related to patent trolls, but it's one that I'm interested in. And it got some attention when reform happened, but I don't know how much, which is the disclosure requirements in patents, that the reforms from the AIA did change the disclosure requirements in patents. So, the deal theoretically and practically in patents is that you get this monopoly, but in turn you share knowledge with the public. And so while the knowledge can't, as we've talked about, actually sell or make the same exact product that is patented, you can work around it and you can improve and so forth. And those disclosure requirements have changed quite a bit post-patent reform. And I'm curious on your perspective on that. I mean, how much? What's your view on the changes with regard to disclosure? And is that an issue that's related to patent trolls at all?
Right. I think it's not as related because in litigation, the name of the game is the claim and whether there's infringement. And usually issues about the disclosure, which is whether the disclosure actually really teaches you to practice the patent, they tend not to be as big. I think there is a big problem with patent lack of disclosure, particularly in the software area, and this is something that's related to functional claiming, is that in reality, a lot of patents, they don't give you any more information than if someone had just told you to solve the problem. That if you have so there's a case, Lotus, who is suing, a patent troll Lotus is suing app developers for using, for in-app purchases. And this is a patent that's from the early 90s, and it actually relates to remote customer feedback for things like fax machines. And if someone was trying to make an app today that on a smartphone that includes in-app purchase functionality, the Lotus patent would give them absolutely no help. And so there's this real disconnect between what people are claiming and what the disclosures actually teach and how useful they are. And, you know, often you'll hear engineers joke that once the lawyers are finished with the patents, even the inventors don't understand them. So I think the disclosure, the quality of patent disclosures is a big problem. And the AIA, particularly by watering down what's known as the best mode requirement, which is the idea that you're supposed to teach the best version of your invention and not hold that back as a trade secret, it did even more harm. That there's sort of another joke. If you want to know what technology a company really considers important, then don't look at its patents, because like that's what it's told the world, that it holds back the really important stuff. And you'll see that with tactical patenting, where people will patent components where the really key ways about how these components are combined are held back as trade secrets.
And so is there any, to your knowledge, is there any effort, again, on the reform side to address any of the disclosure changes that were made in the most recent reforms?
No, not that I know of. There's the information. There's reform efforts on transparency, which is transparency about ownership of patents and who has an interest in litigation, but not in disclosure in the sense of the technological teachings of the patent.
And why is that? Can you speculate as to why that issue hasn't also been a focus?
You know, and I think this goes back to when I said earlier I actually agree with those that say there's been too much focus on trolling. And that's because the problem has been phrased, just the current wave of reform really is just being aimed at trolls. And so it's not dealing with bigger questions of patent quality. And the opposition to reform that addresses low patent quality is really strong. And the people in Congress know that there are a lot of big companies with big patent portfolios that will be very upset if there is a move there. Mm-hmm. And I think in the long term, that's something that EFF is really concerned about, and that as part of our sort of long-term thinking, we're really focused on.
Daniel Naser, staff attorney and policy analyst at EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. This is obviously a topic that, as you just indicated, is only going to continue to be on the front burner and in different aspects of it. So thank you so much for joining us today. I invite you back on the show as we continue the discussion. But thanks much for taking the time today to discuss this pressing issue.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to mention a couple of guests coming up in the remaining few shows in the fall quarter on KZCFM's schedule. Coming up next week is Professor Alistair Roberts from Suffolk Law, author of the book The End of Dissent. We are then going to have on Denise Howell from the terrific law podcast This Week in Law, she and I are going to be discussing podcasting and issues involving podcasting. And then I'm going to reserve an announcement with regard to show 200, which is now going to air on December 11th for probably next week. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live this quarter Wednesdays at 4 o'clock Pacific time on KZSU-FM Stanford. Or you can get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. You can also get the show by going to the page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford. That's cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Or you can go as well to the iTunes page for CIS, and where you can get not only Hearsay Culture, but other events going on at CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.